are especially pleased to have Professor George here with us today because of his impressive credentials and the kind of work he does. Robert P. George is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and the founder and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institution at Princeton University. He's also a professor of politics and an associated faculty member of the Department of Philosophy at Princeton. Professor George currently serves as a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. He's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has previously served as a presidential appointee on the United States Commission on Civil Rights and as a judicial fellow at the United States Supreme Court. A graduate of Swarthmore College and Harvard Law School, Professor George also earned a master's degree in theology from Harvard and a doctorate in philosophy of law from Oxford University. He's the author of numerous books and articles and has advocated many interesting and important positions. Among many other things, Professor George has been one of the most able and articulate advocates of the proposition that faith and reason are not incompatible. Faith and reason are mutually supportive, he has written, the two wings on which the human spirit rises to contemplation of the truth, in the words of Pope John Paul II. Indeed, Professor George has asserted, Christians and other believers are right to defend their positions on key moral issues as rationally superior to the alternatives proposed by those who have abandoned traditional moral principles. Opponents of these traditional principles can be shown to be stuck, he asserts, not because they have been beaten over the head with the Bible, but on the plane where they have made the argument, the plane of rationality. His presentation today is entitled, On the Moral Purposes of Law and Government. Now, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Robert P. George.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Vice President Worthen. President Samuelson, distinguished members of the administration and faculty, fellow disciples of our Lord and our Savior, Jesus Christ, my prayer for each of you who is here today, especially those of you who are students, is that you will continue always to walk in His ways, and that this university will always be a place where students come to learn and then go forth to serve. It's a tremendous honor for me to be here. I've been looking forward to this visit eagerly. It's an opportunity to visit with some old friends, Richard Williams, Ralph Hancock, other members of the faculty. And I'm especially glad to be here with two dear recent friends. And I want to thank this university for lending them to us at the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University, where they were with us for a year. I'm speaking of Professor Matt Holland of the Department of Political Science and Professor Paul Carey in the Department of History. It was a joy to have them with us. They are members of our family, and I'm delighted to be with you, their family, here at the Y. I am going to be speaking today on the moral purposes of law and government. And I'm going to be talking especially about two very important issues of life and issues of marriage and the family. These are not the only important issues, but they are profoundly important issues. They are profoundly important issues because they are foundational issues. They are goods, our lives as human beings, the institution of marriage and the family in which we are nurtured, on which so much that is also good and true and beautiful and noble depends. The obligations and purposes of law and government are these: to protect public health, safety, and morals, and to advance the general welfare, including preeminently protecting people's fundamental rights and basic liberties. Now, at first blush, this classic formulation, or one might say combination of formulations, seems to grant vast and sweeping powers to public authority. Yet in truth, the general welfare, the common good, requires that government be limited. We in America rightly believe in the ideal of limited government. Government's responsibility is primary when the questions involve defending the nation from attack and subversion, protecting people from physical assaults and other forms of depredation, and maintaining public order. In other ways, however, its role is subsidiary, important to be sure, but subsidiary. That is to support the work of families, religious communities, and other institutions of civil society, civic associations, organizations such as the Boy Scouts, institutions that shoulder the primary burden of forming decent, upright citizens, caring for those in need, and encouraging people to meet their responsibilities to one another while also discouraging them from harming themselves or others. Governmental respect for individual freedom and the autonomy and authority of non-governmental spheres is then a requirement of political morality. Government must not try to run people's lives or usurp the roles and responsibilities of families, churches, and other religious associations, and other character and culture-forming authoritative communities. The usurpation of the just authority of families, religious communities, and other institutions is unjust in principle. Government does an injustice when it undermines the authority of the family, when it undermines the autonomy and authority of the church. Often the injustice is serious because it harms those institutions and thus harms the people that they so importantly serve. And we know that the record of big government in the 20th century, even when it did not degenerate, as it did in some cases, into vicious forms of totalitarianism, shows that government, often when it overreaches, does little good, and in the long run, frequently harms those whom it seeks to help. Now, limited government is a key tenet of what I would call classic liberalism, the liberalism of people like James Madison or Alexis de Tocqueville. Today, however, it's interesting that the ideal of limited government is regarded as a conservative ideal. Well, labels don't matter, whether we call it conservative or liberal or whether it shifted from being something defended by liberals in one age to conservatives in another. These things shift. I mean, the person holding the same views might count as a liberal in one epoch and as a conservative in another. What matters is this. We should honor the ideal of limited government, but also not go overboard in another direction by embracing the view that's sometimes called libertarianism. The strict libertarian position, it seems to me, goes much too far in depriving government even of its subsidiary role. It underestimates the importance of maintaining a reasonably healthy moral ecology, moral environment, especially for the rearing of children, and it misses the legitimate role of government in supporting non-governmental institutions that do shoulder the main burden, the family, the church, the main burden of assisting those in need. Still, having said that, having offered that criticism of strict libertarianism, still, I want to acknowledge that libertarianism responds to certain truths about big government, especially in government's bureaucratic and managerial dimensions. Economic freedom cannot guarantee political liberty and the just autonomy of the institutions of civil society. But in the absence of economic liberty, other honorable personal and institutional freedoms are rarely secure. Moreover, the concentration of economic power in the hands of the government is something every true friend of civil liberties should by now have learned to fear. But there is an even deeper truth, one going beyond economics, to which libertarianism responds, and it's this. Law and government exist to protect human persons and secure their well-being, provide the condition for their flourishing. It's not the other way round, as communist and other forms of collectivist ideology suppose. Individuals are not mere cogs in a larger social wheel whose dignity and fundamental rights can be sacrificed for the sake of some alleged greater social good. Government exists for people. People don't exist to serve the interests of larger collectivities, governments, states, future communist utopias. Stringent norms of justice, political justice, forbid persons from being treated as mere servants or instrumentalities of the state. And those governments that do treat their people as mere instrumentalities of the state, do them a grave injustice and violate basic human rights. These norms of political justice equally exclude the sacrificing of the dignity and rights of the person for the sake of some larger social good. It's a profound mistake to suppose that the principle of limited government is rooted in the denial of moral truth or a putative requirement of governments to refrain from acting on the basis of judgments about moral truth. For our commitment to limited government is itself the fruit of moral conviction. It is a moral belief. It's not a belief founded on the idea that nobody can know the moral truth. Quite the opposite. It's an assertion of something held out to be the moral truth. This conviction is ultimately founded on truths that our nation's founders proclaimed as self-evident, namely, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At the foundation is the proposition that each human being, every member of the human family, possesses a profound, inherent, and equal dignity simply by virtue of his nature as a rational creature, a creature possessing, albeit in limited measure, of course, and in some cases merely in rudimentary or root form, the powers of reason and freedom, powers that make possible such human and humanizing phenomena as intellectual inquiry, aesthetic appreciation, respect for self and others, the quest for communion with God, friendship with each other, and love. This great truth of natural law, which is at the heart of our civilizational and civic order, has its theological expression in the biblical teaching that man, unlike the brute animals, is made in the very image and likeness of the Creator and ruler of the universe. Now, it's critical to bear this great truth in mind when we think about the moral purposes of law and government. We must not adopt a merely pragmatic understanding or speak only of practical considerations in addressing the pressing, morally charged issues of our day. Sound positions cannot be effectively advanced and defended by citizens and statesmen who are unwilling or unable to engage moral arguments. That's why we should, in my opinion, rededicate ourselves to understanding and making the moral argument for example, the sanctity of human life in all stages and conditions, and the dignity of marriage as the conjugal union of a man and a woman. Now, please do not misunderstand me. I'm not saying that practical consideration should or even can be left out of the argument. In a proper understanding of morality, practical considerations are never merely practical. The moral case for the reform of unilateral divorce laws, for example, includes reference to the devastating, poverty-inducing, crime-promoting social consequences of the collapse of a healthy marriage culture and the role of unilateral divorce in contributing to that collapse. The moral argument for restoring legal protection to the unborn child includes reference to the adverse psychological and, in some cases, physical consequences of abortion on many women who undergo the procedure. Our task, as I see it, should be to understand the moral truth and speak it in season and out. Speak it lovingly, speak it civilly, engage those with whom one disagrees in civil discourse, open to hearing counterarguments, open to considering the other side's point of view. Yes, speak it lovingly, speak it civilly, but firmly and vigorously, because so much is at stake. Now, we will be told by those who are pure pragmatists that the American public is too far gone in moral relativism or even moral delinquency to be reached by moral argument. Sometimes they say, give it up. Give up the argument for life. Give up the argument for marriage. The public's too far gone. They've drunk the Kool-Aid of moral relativism. But we must have faith. I am assuming you're at this university because you have faith that truth is luminous and powerful. So that if we bear witness to the truth about, say, marriage or the sanctity of human life, lovingly, civilly, but also passionately and with determination, and if we honor the truth in advancing our positions, then even many of our fellow citizens who now find themselves on the other side of these issues will come around. Don't underestimate our fellow citizens. People are open to the argument. Our problem is not so much that people are gone and sunk in moral relativism and so won't listen. Our problem is we don't make the argument, or we don't make it often enough or well enough, with enough conviction, determination. Now, to speak of truth frightens some people today. In the kind of university environments in which I usually spend my time, people get very nervous when you talk about the truth. They evidently believe that people who claim to know the truth about anything, and especially about moral matters, are fundamentalists and potential totalitarians. But as my friend Professor Hadley Arkus has patiently explained, those on the other side of the great moral debates over issues such as abortion and marriage make truth claims, moral truth claims, all the time. They assert their positions with no less confidence and no more doubt than one finds in the advocacy of pro-lifers or defenders of conjugal marriage. They proclaim, for example, not as some mere matter of abstract opinion, but as something true, that women have a fundamental right even to elective abortion. They maintain, with all the conviction that you can have when you're speaking something you believe to be true, that love makes a family. Therefore, any two people, or perhaps more than two people, who feel affection for each other should constitute what is recognized as a marriage. The question, then, is not whether there are truths about such things as the morality of elective abortion and the nature of marriage. The question in each case is, what is the truth? What is centrally and decisively true about human beings in all stages of development, including those in the embryonic and fetal stages, is that they are living individuals of the species Homo sapiens, members of the human family. In the case of embryonic and fetal human beings, they are members of the human family at the earliest stages of their natural development. Each of us, everyone in this room, everyone in the country, every adult, was once an embryo, just as he or she was once an adolescent, and before that a child, and before that an infant, and before that a fetus. Each of us began our lives as a tiny embryo. Each of us developed from the embryonic into and through the fetal, infant, child, and adolescent stages, and ultimately into adulthood, with his or her unity, determinateness, and identity fully intact. As modern embryology confirms beyond any possibility of doubt, and here I'm not appealing to the Bible or the authority of Christian tradition or to any other non-scientific authority, here I'm appealing simply to the authority of science. Beyond any doubt, we were never mere parts of our mothers. We were from the beginning complete, self-integrating organisms that developed to maturity by a gradual and gapless and self-directed process. So our foundational principle of the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of every human being, something that's not established by science, but rather by our philosophical conviction, reinforced by our religious beliefs, this principle at the heart of the American founding, expressed in the Declaration of Independence, demands that all members of the human family be respected and protected, irrespective not only of race and sex and ethnicity, but also irrespective of age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency, to exclude anyone from the law's protection, to permit anyone to be arbitrarily excluded, treated as an object, treated as an instrument or property or killed, is to treat such a person profoundly unjustly. And so it seems to me that justice demands our resolute opposition to the killing of human embryos for biomedical research and in elective abortion. If we would do unto others as we would have them do unto us, then we will insist that law and public policy respect the lives of every member of the human family, just as we expect and demand law and public policy to protect our lives, including those members of the human family that the late Paul Ramsey, the great Methodist ethicist, called the edges of life, the unborn, the severely handicapped, the frail elderly. we must not continue or let our nation continue down the path of treating some lives as, in that chilling phrase, that chilling German phrase, Lebensunswertes Leben, life unworthy of life. We must not draw distinctions between human beings that would license us killing those who are unborn or newly born, or those who are severely retarded, or those who are in dementia, suffering from dementias, or in minimally conscious states, or who are suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Now, of course, politics is the art of the possible. And as Frederick Douglass reminded us in his great tribute to Lincoln, public opinion and other constraints sometimes limit what can be done at the moment to advance any just cause. The pro-life movement, for example, has in recent years settled on an incrementalist strategy for protecting nascent human life. So long as incrementalism is not a euphemism for surrender or neglect, it can, in my opinion, be entirely honorable. Many lives have been saved, and many more can be saved, by laws forbidding, for example, the public funding of abortion, or requiring parental consent or at least notification for abortions performed on minors, or mandating full disclosure to women contemplating abortions of factual information regarding the development of their child and the possible physical and mental health consequences of submitting to abortion, or forbidding late-term abortions and particularly gruesome methods of abortion, such as partial birth abortion, or banning the production of human beings by cloning or other methods for purposes of research in which they are destroyed in the embryonic or early fetal stages. Moreover, planting premises in the law whose logic demands, in the end, full respect for all members of the human family can be a valuable thing to do even where those premises seem modest. Consider, for example, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, enacted by Congress 2 years ago, signed into law by President Bush. This is a law that simply, as a modest first step, protects the child who happens to survive an abortion and is born alive. That doesn't happen very often, but it does happen a certain number of times each year. It's not that thousands of babies are saved, but it plants in the law the idea that the child remains a child, whether he or she is wanted or not. The child remains a child, even if it was a child who had been marked for abortion and happened somehow to survive that abortion. The logic of that position, recognizing the dignity of the child, inexorably leads us to reconsider, leads those who are adopting the so-called pro-choice position to reconsider the logical soundness, the intellectual credibility of that position. Let me turn to the other great moral question we confront today. And again, I'm not suggesting these are the only two important questions at a time when we're at war, a controversial war, at a time when we face international terrorism, at a time when we're in an economic crisis of, if not unprecedented proportions, then certainly one that's very serious by comparison even with normal recessions. I would never say that these are the only issues, but I would remind you that they are important issues, and they're important issues because they're foundational issues, and they're foundational because so much else that's important depends on them. Now, the institution of marriage is battered in our larger American culture, but it is not lost. Much damage was done by legislation and bad policy, almost always in the name of reform. That legislation and policy is now itself in need of reform. If we are to restore and secure the institution of marriage, we must recover a sound understanding of what marriage is and why it's in the public interest for law and policy to take cognizance of it and to support it. One of the reasons I so admire the LDS Church is the commitment of the Church to the institution of marriage, the profound statements that the Church has been willing to make on the family and on the divine institution of marriage, and the willingness of the Church, and by the Church I mean not just the leadership structure, but the leadership structure has been exemplary, but also the LDS faithful around the country to put their financial resources and their own time and effort and attention into the struggle to protect marriage. Let me say to those, and I know the majority of you are LDS members, let me say to those that I salute you and I admire you and I admire the Church for what you've done on this issue. Now, marriage is a pre-political form of association, what might be called a natural institution. It's not created by law, though law recognizes and regulates it in every culture we know about. Nowhere is marriage treated as a mere private matter. Now, some on the libertarian fringe toy with the idea that marriage could be privatized, and even some who are not on the fringe wonder whether that might be, in the circumstances, the best solution to the controversy over what's called sometimes same-sex marriage or gay marriage. Now, I understand why someone would consider this idea. Can't we get out of this simply by privatizing it, leaving marriage to churches, treating it as if it were like a baptism or a bar mitzvah or a confirmation? Nevertheless, the idea strikes me as a bad one, a spectacularly bad one. There is a reason that all cultures treat marriage as a matter of public concern and even recognize it by law and regulate it. The family is the fundamental unit of society. It is the original and best department of health, education, and welfare. Governments rely on families to produce something that governments need, vitally need, rely on, can't get along without, but that on their own, governments could never possibly produce. What's that? It's upright, decent, honest people who make law-abiding, public-spirited citizens. Government can't produce that. Government depends on it vitally. I mean, if you're a government and you're trying to govern an utterly lawless people, an utterly immoral people, people who only respect the law because of the fear of punishment, it won't work. Legal philosophers have long known that the law will work only when the majority of people are obeying the law out of moral conviction and not simply out of fear of punishment. But government can't produce such people. It relies on non-governmental institutions, fundamentally the family, assisted by the church, to other civic associations, to produce those people. The transmission of virtue is primarily, overwhelmingly, in the hands of the family and the church, not the government. And marriage is, of course, the foundation, the indispensable foundation of the family. Although all marriages and all cultures have their imperfections, children flourish in an environment where they benefit from the love and care of mother and father, and from the committed and exclusive love of their parents for each other. Those who've studied the consequences of divorce, Judith Wallerstein, Barbara Defoe Whitehead, and most recently and powerfully Elizabeth Marquardt, those who study the effects on children of divorce, found some surprising things. They found not merely that children don't do very well on the whole in such situations of family breakdown. They even found that the divorce of parents of adult children harms those adult children. That even as adults, we are somehow deeply invested emotionally in our parents' marriages. There was a time when some of you can remember it as I can, in the 60s and 70s, when a lot of people in the social sciences and psychology, proposed something that a lot of other people desperately wanted to believe, and that was that, well, we should have pretty free and easy divorce because it'll be better for the kids if parents who are squabbling all the time separate. That'll be better for the kids. The kids are harmed by all this fussing and squabbling. It's a rather convenient thing to believe. Turned out, though, not to be true. And 40 years of experience now subjected to social science research by people like Wallerstein and Whitehead have shown that that truth, which would have been convenient if true for a lot of people, is just not true. Now, anyone who believes in limited government should strongly back government support of the family. Don't mean necessarily financial support. That gets into a very interesting, different set of issues. But government support for the institution of the family, the special recognition that we give to marriage and the family, the special status we give it, the special respect we give it, the special encouragement we give it through the structure of our laws. Now, this shouldn't sound paradoxical. Why here? Well, in the absence of a strong marriage culture, families fail to form. We now know that from the experience of so many of our inner cities. And when they do form, they are often unstable. Absentee fathers become a serious problem, out-of-wedlock births become common, and a train of social pathologies follows. With families failing to perform their health, education, and welfare functions, what happens? It's predictable. the demand for government grows. Somebody's got to step in to deal with the problems, whether in the form of greater policing or as a provider of other social services. Bureaucracies then have to be created, whether they're for, you know, increased policing or for delivery of social services. And these bureaucracies inexorably expand, and indeed, we all know it, they become powerful lobbyists for their own preservation and expansion. Everyone suffers, with the poor and most vulnerable members of our society suffering the most. We need to rebuild the family in so many places where we have such breakdown, not primarily for the sake of the middle class or upper class, although they suffer too from family breakdown. The real victims of the loss, the decline, the erosion of the integrity of the institution of marriage are the poor and vulnerable who depend so vitally on that institution. The effective defense of marriage against the current onslaught will require an understanding of marriage as a matter of moral truth. Practical or pragmatic arguments are legitimate and important, but too few pro-marriage politicians are willing to say much about what marriage actually is. This gives those who would abolish the conjugal conception of marriage, replace it, redefine marriage, an important advantage in the public debate. They hammer away with their rhetoric of love makes a family and demand to know how anyone's marriage would be threatened if the same-sex partners next door were allowed to marry. You've all heard that argument. Why is it any concern to you? Why does it hurt your marriage, hurt your family, hurt your church if the law recognizes the marriage as a marriage, the relationship of the same-sex partners next door? And a lot of people seem to be stumped on the pro-marriage side. I'm stumped by that argument. Well, everyone agrees that marriage, whatever else it is or does, is a relationship in which persons are united. It's a union of persons. But what are persons? What does it mean to be a person? And how is it possible for two persons to unite? How is it possible for two persons to become one? According to the view implicit in sexual liberationist ideology, the person is understood as the conscious and desiring aspect of the self. A person is fundamentally a consciousness, a center of emotion, thought. The person thus understood inhabits a body, but the body is regarded, if only implicitly in many cases, not as a personal part of the human being or a part of the person, but as a subpersonal aspect of the self. The body is viewed as serving the interests of the conscious and desiring aspect of the self by functioning as an instrument by which the individual produces or otherwise participates in satisfactions and other desirable experiences and realizes various objectives and goals. For those who formally or informally accept this understanding of what human beings are, personal unity cannot be achieved by bodily union as such. Bodily union can't be personal union because the body's not part of the personal reality of the human being. It's an extrinsic object used by the real person, the consciousness, the conscious and desiring self, in order to produce satisfactions that are desired. So persons unite, if they unite at all, by uniting emotionally. And of course, if this is true, then persons of the same sex can unite and share sexual experiences together that they suppose will enhance their personal union by enabling them to express affection, share the uniquely intense pleasure of sex, and feel more intensely by virtue of their sex play together. The alternative view, what persons is or are, is the one embodied in our both in our historic law of marriage and in what Isaiah Berlin, the great British philosopher and historian of ideas, referred to as the central tradition of Western thought. According to this view, human beings are not non-bodily persons who inhabit and use non-personal bodies as mere extrinsic instruments. The body is no mere instrument for inducing satisfactions for the sake of the conscious and desiring aspect of the self. Rather, a human person, as we're constituted here on this earth, is a dynamic unity of body, mind, and spirit. The body, far from being a mere instrument, is intrinsically part of the reality of the human being. Bodily union, therefore, is personal union. And comprehensive personal union, marital union, is founded on bodily union. Marriage as a comprehensive sharing of life means a union at all stages, all levels of a human being. The bodily, the emotional, the dispositional, the rational, the spiritual. But what's special about marital friendship, making it different from all other forms of friendship and sharing and unity, is that at all of the levels at which life is shared, the sharing is founded upon, the foundation of it is bodily communion. That also helps to make sense of the historic requirement, for example, of the consummation of marriage. It also explains why marriage can be only two people and not three or five or seven. Two people can unite as a reproductive unit. They can fulfill the behavioral conditions of reproduction, whether or not the non-behavioral conditions happen to obtain. But that's not something that three people or five people do. If marriage is merely an emotional union, because the person is merely the emotional center, the conscious and desiring self, the body not being a part of the personal reality of the human being, then it's true that sexual complementarity is no part of the picture. Two people of the same sex can be emotionally united. But by the same token, so can three or five or seven. So no account, no intelligible account can be given. No rational principle can be identified for saying why marriage should be two and only two people rather than three or four or five. Fundamentally, it's clear that any argument that would give you, if you wanted to get there, a justification for same-sex marriage would equally give you an argument for polyamory, understanding marriage as available to more than two people, three or five or seven, sharing sexual relations as a unit. So, what's unique about marriage is that it truly is a comprehensive sharing of life, a sharing founded on bodily union made uniquely possible by the sexual complementarity of man and woman, a complementarity that itself makes possible for two human beings to become, in the language of the Bible in Genesis, one flesh, and for this one flesh union to be the foundation of a relationship in which it is intelligible for two people to bind themselves to each other in pledges of permanence, exclusivity, and fidelity. When the Bible teaches us in Genesis that a man shall leave his mother, a woman leave her home, and the two shall become one flesh, the two shall be one flesh, it doesn't say the two shall be so emotionally close that it will be as if they were one flesh. It doesn't say that it doesn't speak metaphorically as if this closeness is kind of like it would be to be one flesh. The two will be one flesh. It's right there telling us that the bodily communion of spouses is the essence of marriage, the foundation of marriage. It's not all that marriage is, but it's foundational and essential to marriage. Now, on this understanding, the one included, again, not only in the Bible, but in the larger Western tradition, Plato himself, as my teacher John Finnis has demonstrated beautifully in an article that he published on the subject, even Plato was able to identify the same basic understanding. On this understanding, the body is not treated as a mere instrument of the conscious and desiring aspect of the self, whose interests and satisfactions are the putative ends to which sexual acts are means, nor is sex itself instrumentalized. The one-flesh unity of marriage is not merely an instrumental good, a reason for acting whose intelligibility as a reason depends on other ends to which it's a means. This unity is an intrinsic good. Marriage is an intrinsic human good, not just an instrument for other things, a reason for acting whose intelligibility as a reason depends on no ulterior reason or end. The central and justifying point of sex is not pleasure, however sexual pleasure is rightly sought, as an aspect of the perfection of marital union, and it is rightly sought. But the fundamental and justifying point, rather, is marriage itself, considered as an irreducible, essentially and irreducibly bodily union of persons, a union effectuated by acts of sexual congress. Because sex is not instrumentalized in marital acts, such acts are free of the self-alienating qualities that have made wise and thoughtful people, from Plato to Augustine, and from the biblical writers to Kant, Christians and non-Christians alike, Jews and even virtuous pagans such as Plato and Aristotle, have caused really thoughtful people always to treat sexual morality as a matter of the utmost seriousness. On the sexual liberationist wing today, sex is just not regarded as a serious thing. It's like any other innocent pleasure. It has no moral significance beyond the pleasure that it can give or that people can share with each other. So why all these hang-ups, you religious people, they say? Why do all you religious people have so much, all these hang-ups about sex? It's because those of us who are religious, and even some of us who are not, but who are morally serious, see what Kant saw, see what Plato saw, see what Augustine saw, that sex is so integral to who we are as human beings that it's a very, very serious thing. In truly marital acts, the desire for pleasure and even for offspring are integrated with and, in an important sense, subordinated to the central and defining good of one flesh marital unity. The integration of subordinate goals with the marital good ensures that such acts effect no practical dualism that separates the body from the conscious and desiring aspect of the self and treats the body as a mere instrument for producing pleasure or any other extrinsic good. But one might ask, well, what about procreation? On the traditional view of marriage, is not the sexual union of spouses instrumentalized to the goal of having children? Christians sometimes ask that question. Now, it's true that St. Augustine, in certain writings, seems to be a proponent of this view. The conception of marriage as an instrumental good, though, was rejected by the mainstream of philosophical and theological reflection from the Middle Ages forward, certainly in the writings of Aquinas, for example. And the understanding of sex and marriage that came to be embodied in both the canon law of the church and the civil law of the state does not treat marriage as merely instrumental to having children. Western matrimonial law, as traditionally and universally understood, has marriage as consummated by acts fulfilling the behavioral conditions of procreation, again, whether or not the non-behavioral conditions happen to obtain at the time or, for that matter, ever in the relationship. By contrast, the sterility of spouses, the inability of spouses to have children, so long as the spouses are capable of consummating their marriage by fulfilling the behavioral conditions of procreation and thus obtaining true bodily, organic, personal unity, has never been treated as an impediment to marriage, even where sterility is certain and even certain to be permanent. Children who may be conceived in marital acts are understood not as ends extrinsic to marriage, but rather as gifts, fulfilling for the couple as a marital unit, and not merely as individuals, gifts that supervene on acts whose central and defining justifying point is precisely marital unity, the marital unity of spouses. Now, I and others have elsewhere developed more fully the moral case for the conjugal conception of marriage as the union of one man and one woman, pledged to permanence and fidelity and committed to caring for children who may come as the fruit of matrimonial union. I've argued, as I've mentioned today, that the acceptance of the idea that two persons of the same sex could actually be married to each other would make nonsense of key features of marriage and would necessarily require abandoning any ground of principle for supposing that marriage is the union of only two persons as opposed to three or four or more as a unit, so-called polyamory. Only a thin veneer of sentiment, if it happens to exist and only for as long as it exists, could prevent acceptance of polyamory as a legitimate marital option once we've given up the idea, the principle, of marriage as a male-female union. To those arguments, I will here add an additional reason to reject the idea of same-sex marriage, and a very, very important one. The acceptance of the idea would result, indeed it is already resulting, in a massive undermining of religious liberty and family autonomy, as supporters of same-sex marriage would and are now, in the name of equality, demanding the use of governmental power to whip others, churches and other institutions, into line. The experience of Massachusetts, as well as now in California as well, and many foreign jurisdictions, is that once marriage is compromised or formally redefined, principles of non-discrimination law are quickly used as cudgels against religious communities and families who wish to uphold true marriage by precept and example. The idea that the marriage recognition, the laws recognizing the couple next door who are of the same sex as being married, has no bearing on your life, has no bearing on your family, has no bearing on your religious community, turns out to be spectacularly false. We've seen in Massachusetts Catholic charities driven out of the adoption business, simply because it insisted on being faithful to its church's own teaching about the nature of marriage. And so after 100 years of placing orphan children in good homes, it was forced to give up its license or compromise its moral principle. And of course, it gave up its license rather than place children in the homes of same-sex sexually active couples. We see it now in California. We see it in schools where students are subjected to curricula that their parents have a very difficult time opting them out of, and some jurisdictions are not permitted to opt out of, where they are taught that marriage is the union of any two people. Love makes a family. If their parents think something different, the view that's communicated to the children is that their parents are bigots. Their parents are suffering from mere irrational phobias. Their parents are guilty of the same sort of thing that people in an earlier generation were guilty of when they discriminated against blacks or Jews or other minorities. What's at stake are things like licensing rights, radio stations, tax-exempt status. We had in my home state of New Jersey a Methodist institution which lost the tax-exempt status for a piece of its property. It was a pavilion, beautiful pavilion on the sea, on the New Jersey coast, where the Methodist community had invited and permitted other people who even weren't Methodists to hold their marriages in the pavilion, in that beautiful place. When a same-sex couple wished to take advantage of this and have their marriage in the pavilion, the Methodist Church said, well, we're very sorry, but our church teaches that homosexual conduct is wrong and that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, so you know we can't give permission, consistent with our own moral conviction and theology, we can't give permission for you to use that pavilion. What happened? Their tax-exempt status was stripped. That's what happened. Now, part of the trouble pro-marriage politicians and others have in defending marriage follows from the fact that these pathologies that afflict the marriage culture are widespread, and supporters of marriage, being human, are not immune to them. Now, this is not to excuse anyone from personal responsibility. But the fact is that sustaining a marriage, despite the collapse of many of its social supports, is difficult. And trying to stand up for marriage, political leaders, intellectuals, and activists who have themselves had marital problems are subjected to charges of hypocrisy. Many, therefore, censor themselves. There are many politicians, because they have been divorced, they have had marital problems, simply feel that they cannot speak out without being accused as hypocrites if they speak out in the defense of marriage. So we get the phenomenon of self-censorship. As a result, the pro-marriage movement has lost the leadership of some of its most talented and articulate people. Now, the question of same-sex marriage is critically important, but rebuilding and renewing the marriage culture goes far beyond it. By abolishing the basic understanding of marriage as inherently a conjugal union, the legal recognition of same-sex marriage would be, in my opinion, disastrous. But many would say that such recognition would simply ratify the collapse of marriage that followed from the widespread acceptance of divorce, non-marital sexual cohabitation, and other factors having nothing to do with homosexual conduct. Now, it's true that the origins of the pathologies afflicting marriage lie in those factors. Rebuilding the marriage culture will require careful incremental legal reforms to roll back unilateral divorce, accompanied by Herculean efforts on the part of non-governmental institutions, especially churches and religious bodies, to prepare couples more adequately for marriage. Most of our churches don't do that very well. I think the LDS Church is an exception there, but so many of our churches don't prepare married couples very well, or help them to nurture strong marital relationships, or give them mentorship, or assist them in dealing with marital problems. People are beginning to recognize this now. A lot of evangelical churches are doing a better job. Some Catholic bishops have taken this seriously, trying to do a better job of helping people through marital problems. Public-private work together will be needed. Government and private organizations are going to have to work together to build the marriage culture. And this won't be easy. But if marriage were not so important, then it wouldn't be worth trying. But marriage is vitally important, so we have to do it. As with abortion, same-sex marriage is being advanced by socially liberal activist judges who exercise creative powers of constitutional interpretation. The three U.S. states that currently have same-sex marriage, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and California, have it not as the result of democratic deliberation, but as direct imposition by the judiciary. That gives us additional reason to pursue with new determination the larger fight against the judicial usurpation of democratic legislative authority, another profound abuse of government power. Some people have wondered whether the best way to handle the conflict over marriage in our politics would be a federalist solution, one that eschews a national policy on marriage and leaves it to each state to define marriage as it sees fit. I can see the appeal of that idea, although I think in the end it doesn't hold. Just as the nation could not endure, as Lincoln said, half slave and half free, but eventually had to go all one way or all the other, we will not be able to get by with a situation in which some couples are married in one state, say California, not married when they travel through another state, say Utah, and are married again when they reach a third state, say Colorado. If same-sex marriage is legally recognized in a small number of states, it will spread throughout the nation, either through judicial action under the Constitution's full faith and credit clause, or by the working of informal cultural pressures. Some states, Utah would be one, may try to hold out, but sooner or later, they will be whipped into line. The judiciary will eventually find you. That's why we need a national resolution of the issue, and probably a constitutional one, though it looks like we're far from having the support at the national level in Congress to do that. Believers in marriage did not start this fight, and we are loath to interfere with traditional state powers, precisely because we view federalism as serving the ideal of limited government and embodying our belief in the principle of subsidiarity. But judicial usurpation has now put into operation a chain of events that will result in the radical redefinition of marriage across the country unless action is taken, action at the national level, going beyond the Defense of Marriage Act, which may yet be struck down by the courts, to preserve the conjugal conception of marriage. Well, the defense of life against abortion and embryo-destructive research calls America back to the founding principles of our regime, our nation, and to reflection on the justifying point and purposes of law and government. The defense of marriage shores up the cultural preconditions of a regime of democratic pluralism, a government of Republican nature, a government dedicated to human equality, the proposition that all men are created equal, and to fundamental rights and principled limits on governmental powers. These causes, these moral causes, because they are foundational, because so much else depends on them, should not be regarded, should never be regarded as distractions from other pressing goals, even though there are other pressing goals. The fight against terrorism, the struggle for economic prosperity, the need to assist those who are needy, the need to deal with the problem of poverty in our cities, the needs for environmental protection. These are all important. But the moral causes of life and marriage, are not distractions. They are rather causes that spring from the foundational moral purposes of law and the state. And today, they are certainly among the most urgent causes. Thank you very much. Again, it's such a great honor to be here at BYU. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Very, very honored. God bless BYU.